Welcome into the NHL at the Rink podcast. As always, Dan Rosen here, but in Tampa, in my hotel room right now, staring at Sean Rourke, who I can see is in his hotel room, but I can't see a lot of him. I can see him at the rink, but that's pretty much it, right, Sean? We're in the same location. We actually have the same view outside of our hotel room. I can go out there. You cannot.
No, I'm being punished.
Yes.
But no, in all seriousness, it's great to be here. It's been over 18 months for me since I've seen a live hockey game. So we're doing this on Tuesday. Monday was game one, a 5-1 victory by the Tampa Bay Lightning. And it was the first time I had been in an NHL building. And like I said, over 18 months. So whatever sacrifices have to be made to do that, they'll be made. And the reason that we live under different protocols is because I'm going to Montreal for games 3 and 4, and you're going home. So to be able to enter Canada, we have to stay as quarantined as possible. And again, I'll happily pay that price to see hopefully 6 more games of the Stanley Cup final, but who knows how many it'll be, but it was awesome to be back in the rink.
And didn't it feel like, for me, when I went to games 3 and 6 at Nassau Coliseum, it felt like a privilege to be there. And I almost felt a little sorry that like I maybe got caught taking it for granted a little bit, being at so many games and getting the opportunity to go to these games. But I wonder, did you have that same feeling, Sean, being in the building and feeling that buzz of 16,000 plus in the building for game one, a 5-1 Lightning win? Just that feeling of, man, maybe I did used to take this for granted unknowingly and not that you were doing it on purpose, but almost like a privilege to be back, right?
I felt grateful that and relieved that this opportunity had finally come again. I think you almost forgot over this long period, what we had, and not just us as an NHL.com, but everybody, the ability to go to games and to have that communal experience and to enjoy more than the game, right? Like part of being there as opposed to watching it on TV is everything that goes on around you, that the clear energy that the crowd delivers, the show that's put on in Amalie Arena, just the buzz. I got to be outside for 5 minutes yesterday. We walked from our hotel to the rink, which is one block. But we did walk by Thunder Alley, and which is right outside of Amalie Arena, and just the buzz of a big game day, right? Like there's nothing that compares to it. And yes, I think we all take our jobs for granted and the opportunities that we're given. And this has been a really nice reset. And, part of it might've just been nostalgia and trying to project something on the crowd. But I had the feeling that the people that were there felt a very similar way. Look, it's fun to watch hockey in your living room. Hopefully you have another fan there and you can, your wife or your kids are a fan and you can high five and jump around, but it's not the same thing as having 16,000 people that either feel the same way you do or feel the exact opposite way you do. And you get to abuse them and they get to abuse you. That's a completely different experience and a communal experience that we've all craved for a really long time.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about this with our guests today. We have Kenny Albert. He'll be jumping on with us shortly, calling all games in the final, his first Stanley Cup final, calling all games on NBC. And we also have Tampa Bay Lightning defenseman Jan Ruda, who joined us to talk a little bit about game one, but more importantly about the team in general, where they are, how they got to this point and all that. So those two guys will be coming up shortly. But Sean, you mentioned the fans in the building and all that. Got to bring it up, man. The fan that was sitting basically right behind you. Now to describe where we are, we're not in the press box. We actually have a great setup. We're in a section on the 300 level, and they gave us a big, long table, and there's only four of us in there. It's myself and you, Nick Kotsenik, our columnist, and Corey Long, our correspondent here in Tampa. But we have a lot of separation there. It's a lot of spread out, ability to spread out. But we're in the fans. We're in the crowd. And there was a fan right behind, basically right behind Sean. The whole game, it was great. It was great. He got her in the live blog too, thinking basically it's like she was coaching from her seat. Protect the house. Don't rely on Vassie. Move your feet. Come on, shoot. It was like, like I said, it was like a coach behind you screaming from the bench, except she's screaming from, maybe row 7 in section 313 instead.
you know, those fans sit right above us. We walk in that tunnel at 313 and we sit down and they're right above us. We're on top of the 200 level there. And you know, every fan's different, right? Some fans just sit there quietly and watch the game and want to take everything. Other fans, you know, go crazy. I think this young lady was so nervous that she had to talk the whole game, and whoever she was with would only talk every once in a while, but they would just scream out like random things that, you know, crush them, do this, do that. But she had a constant stream going. My favorite was every time the Montreal Canadiens tried to get into the zone, she'd be like, stand them up. And you know what? They did. I mean, that game was a physical, over 100 hits, scrums around both goalies. You know, both teams have guys that want to get into the goalie's kitchen and rattle some pots and pans. Gallagher for Montreal especially, and he paid a heavy price last night to do that. And then, you know, Cirelli a couple of times for Tampa Bay. Coleman likes to get there. You know, and Montreal has those four horsemen, the big D they have there. And so one of the most physical cup game ones I can remember in a long time.
By the way, the fan did a heck of a job coaching because the Lightning were really good in game one. And it was physical. And I mean, look, we're just looking at game one as we record this on Tuesday. So we got game two coming up Wednesday. But Sean, regardless how this series goes the rest of the way, game one is an indication of the type of physicality we're going to see here. And I say that not just because of, you know, everybody's, you know, all pumped up and ready to go for game one. The Canadians play that way. That's their style, right? I mean, they get in there, they grind, they're defensive, you know, but they hits and they wear you down. And that's how they got this far. But the Lightning play that way too. And they don't get enough credit for that. They just don't get enough credit. And maybe now they're starting to, but even on media day, Luke Richardson, assistant coach for Montreal, acting head coach right now with Dominique Ducharme out until at least game three. He called them an offensive team, you know, very offensive minded team. They are. They can play that way. But you see the way they play in game one. You see the way they played in game seven against the Islanders, or really through the balance of that series. This is a team that can play a physical, hard grinding, put pucks in deep and go get it brand of hockey. And they frankly just played it better than the Montreal Canadiens did in game one. And I picked Tampa in seven. I mean, if you look at 5-1, I think it was closer than 5-1 in some ways, but in some ways the Lightning deserved 5-1 for how they played game one. And I just think you're going to see that physical brand of hockey for the rest of the series. And I don't think you're going to see a Tampa team that's been known in the past to be in that run and gun team back down from this at all.
No, I think they've transformed themselves in such a way that they thrive on it. Right. I think the physical guys thrive on it, and the quote unquote skilled guys are motivated by it. Right. And I think John Cooper feeds into that. You know, one of the things that I wasn't sure at the end, right. The Lightning got a 5-on-4. There weren't a lot of penalties for as physical as the game was. It was not a penalty fest. There weren't a lot of power plays, but they got one late in the game and then it became a 5-on-3. It went back to 5-on-4. Montreal has the best penalty kill in the playoffs. And Cooper had 5 forwards out in a 4-1 game on the power play. And right before the second penalty was the slash on Kucherov's the back of his legs. And so I wasn't sure if it was an attempt to get their power play going against a penalty kill that had scored in 32. I mean, that hadn't allowed a goal in 32 straight kills, or if it was, hey, you want to rough up my stars? Here's what I'm going to do to you. And maybe it was a combination of both, but you know, Kucherov and Point and all of those guys, they really don't mind it. They don't shy away from it. I don't think it's something they look for like a Hedman might or a Cirelli. But they're not afraid of it. And it seems to motivate them when they're targeted.
It's not the first time Cooper did that, by the way. He did that against the Islanders too. And Barzal was, you know, had a late hit and there was a question of whether Matt Barzal would even, you know, be able to play the next game because of a suspension. He did. It was fine. But Cooper threw, you know, his top power play out there in an 8-0 game or a 7-0 game at the time. And, you know, it was just like, you want to go at my guys like this? Well, here's what we're going to throw right back at you, you know, and that's the difference. That's what the Lightning can do. That's why they're the team to beat in this series. They're the better team in this series because they have that ability to play the way Montreal wants to be able to play. But when you, but they have the ability to turn it up too. And we saw that in game one, 2-1 going into the third period. You know, you get a redirection goal from Eric Chernak. You get the deflection goal from Yanni Gord. They give up one late. And then what happens? The big boys take over. Kucherov scores two. Stamkos gets one. And they win it 5-1. And that's, to me, going to be a big difference in this series as it continues to go on here. And, you know, into games 2, 3, 4, whatever it may be, is the Lightning will be able to play the way Montreal wants to play. But then they're going to throw their big boys out there and their big boys will take over.
Yeah, well, you know what? The Vegas Golden Knights had some big boys.
Didn't have Braden Point.
Some really skilled players. And they put up four and made Carey Price look human in game one of that series. You know how many goals they scored in the rest of that series? Six-game series. So in the next five games, they scored 9 goals. What were we saying after game one, right? What were we saying after 4 games of the Toronto series? Like, I just, Carey Price is such a wild card. I don't see him giving up 5 again. And B, I don't know if there's any team in these playoffs that's adjusted as well as Montreal has or has just stayed with what makes them so good despite all the setbacks that they've had. So I expect a much closer game two. And you know, it has to be. I don't think Montreal wants to go home 0-2.
I agree with all that, and I expect – the rest of the series to be, I mean, I thought this, I think it was a 5-1 game, but I think it was a little closer than a 5-1 game looks in terms of score. But you bring up what Montreal has done, and I'll throw this back at you. Against Toronto, John Tavares wasn't playing. It's a big piece for the Toronto Maple Leafs, right? Against Winnipeg, Mark Scheifele wasn't playing. It's a big piece for the Winnipeg Jets. And against Vegas, it's hindsight now. We look at it because Vegas was so good in the regular season and all that stuff, and they get through Colorado. They didn't have a number one center. There's no number one center on that team. It's a big hole for that team. It's a whole other topic of conversation. There's no hole for the Tampa Bay Lightning. Zero holes. Braden Point has probably become my favorite player to watch in the National Hockey League because of the way he plays a 200-foot game. You see the play he made that led to Chernak's goal. I mean, back check, takes the puck, puts it away. You know, it was back check, intercepts the puck, starts to rush the other way. He's terrific. Sorelli's very good. Yanni Gord is in your face. The depth down the middle that the Tampa Bay Lightning have is something that the Montreal Canadiens have not faced. And that's why this is a step up for the Canadiens. Yes, in round, but also just in level of competition.
You know, you mentioned all those people. You didn't even mention Nikita Kucherov.
Well, I'm talking about centers. I'm just saying centers.
But who might be the best player we've seen in the playoffs in a long, long time. Regardless of position, you know, you talk about the last player to have a 1.5 point per game average in the playoffs was Malkin the year he won the MVP in 2009, right? Nobody's come close. And here's Kucherov, you know, 30 plus points in 2 straight playoffs. You know, you're only talking about what? Gretzky, Lemieux, Curry. It's a pretty short list. It's a pretty short, pretty impressive list. And I still don't think he gets the credit he deserves. Steven Stamkos gave it to him after game one. He said he's a beast. And that's what he is, a beast.
Sean, you know who's also a beast? Kenny Albert. The guy never stops working. Does every sport, basically. But he's big into hockey, and he's calling the Stanley Cup final for NBC. He's kind enough to join us right now to give us a few minutes. Kenny, how you doing? How was game one for you?
Well, Dan, you never really know what to expect in a game one, especially when the teams haven't seen each other in over a year. I worked the Vegas-Colorado series in round two, and the Avalanche blew out the Golden Knights 7-1 in that game, and Vegas had just come off a 7-game series against Minnesota. They were tired. They traveled, and then they go on and win 4 of the next 5. And then in the Islanders-Tampa Bay series, it was really a filling-out process. They had not played during the regular season, and it was probably the most boring game if I want to use that word, of the Islanders-Tampa series, which obviously became a lot more exciting as the series moved along. I thought last night it did not take much time for the teams to get to know each other. There did not really seem to be a filling out process. There was a lot of hitting and some nastiness early, and despite the final score, it was a 2-1 game in the third period. So Tampa obviously scored the three goals in the third, and we'll see, you know, what takes place tomorrow night, what kind of a pushback the Canadians bring. But I look at game one as a little bit closer than the final score indicates.
Do you think, Kenny, that there wasn't a feeling out process because neither team can play any other way than what they do? Like in the other series you talked about, the teams could be a little bit flexible in what they do, but both of these teams are so true to their identity that it really doesn't matter who they're playing.
Right. I think that's a big part of it, Sean. That's a good point. I also think that the Lightning learned a lesson from that first game against the Islanders, which they lost on home ice 2-1. And, you know, I think the wins are so precious at this point. We're coming down to the wire and heading into game one. You know, both teams knew it's a race to four for the Stanley Cup. And John Cooper indicated that when we spoke to him yesterday morning, that he felt his team was coming off such a high from game seven against the Islanders that he hoped that his team was not sort of lulled into the same type of series opener that we did see from Tampa Bay against the Islanders. And that was not the case.
Certainly not the case. Kenny, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what you do. And I think we had you on last year when you were in the bubble and you're calling games with no fans. I do believe Bob's shaking his head. Our producer, Bob Bender, shaking his head. But no, I do believe you joined us in the bubble in the playoffs last year. And now, either way, you called games with no fans. Now there's 16,000 some odd in the building. How does that impact the way you call a game, if at all?
Well, I think in the bubble, and I was up in Edmonton for 37 days. The first four were a quarantine in the hotel room, and then started calling games almost every day, including three games in a day twice. And Pierre McGuire and I had the two game sevens in one day, which was such a, you know, when I think back, it was so memorable working Colorado, Dallas, and then Vegas, Vancouver, two game sevens in the span of about 8 hours. That was just a lot of fun for us, even though there were no fans in the building. But last year in the empty arena in Edmonton, I felt like I had to remind myself constantly to keep up the energy and the enthusiasm because there were no fans in the building. We were the only ones there. And I was about 20 rows up. We had a broadcast location right on the first concourse. In fact, one of the referees told me he could actually hear my call of the game on the ice at times when there was no music going and it was really quiet. So, you know, that's obviously unique and different than during normal times. And then this year, early in the season, we were all calling games in empty arenas for our respective teams or for the networks when we did travel on a couple of occasions. And a lot of it this year, as you guys know, we were calling games off monitors, even early in the playoffs. Brian Boucher and I did four of the Tampa Bay, Florida games off monitors from Stamford, Connecticut, just a couple of months ago. So that's obviously a lot different. There are certain things you can't see because you're relying on the feed, on the television screen. But I think we all got through it. I felt like you could see about 85% of what you normally would if you were in the arena. You might miss certain penalties. You might not see exactly when the goalie's pulled. You don't see what's going on at the benches as far as line changes. But we all dealt with it, and I think it actually went a little bit better than a lot of us expected. And then during the playoffs, as you guys know, more and more fans have been in the buildings. And it was in the first round, Boston, Washington. We did a number of those games and there were fans in the building in Boston. And then in the second round, Vegas, Colorado, Colorado home games, about 10,000 in the building. Vegas was pretty full. And then into the third round with Tampa Bay and the Islanders. So exciting, obviously, and Nassau Coliseum with their fans in the building and down here in Tampa as well. And John Cooper alluded to the fact again yesterday that in game 6 and 7, of that Tampa Bay Islander series, he feels like the fans had a profound effect in both cities on the results of those games. So it's great that the fans are back in. It was a terrific crowd last night, 15,000 here in Tampa. We'll see what happens in Montreal. I know they had 3,500 at the previous games in the last round and not sure what's going to take place for games 3 and 4, but Obviously a lot more exciting, and it certainly carries across on the broadcast that excitement level when more fans are in the arenas.
Yeah, they're negotiating right now to try and get to half capacity at the Molson Center, which would
Bell Center,
which would be, you know, awesome. Because you look at those crowds outside and you're like, oh, if you could put all those people inside, they would be fantastic.
Yeah, so, that would be great. And that's always, as you guys know, that's always one of the great buildings in the league as far as the fan excitement, the enthusiasm, the singing in the building. So, you know, there wouldn't be many other buildings you'd rather be in than in Montreal during the Stanley Cup final, even with half of the seats full.
Yeah, no, one of my favorite things to do, because of the way the press box is there, it kind of hangs out a little bit and the fans are behind you. It's one of the rare ones where there's actually fans behind you. I spend not a lot of the game, but every couple of minutes I'll turn around and just watch the crowd behind me instead of the game in front of me, like during whistles and stuff like that. And it's just crazy how knowledgeable that fan base is, how passionate they are, and how much noise they can make. It when they had 3,500 in there in the last round, if you close your eyes, you thought it was a full building.
And you think about the history, of course, in that city. And when you do look back from the press box and the broadcast area at the stands behind you, up top, there are also the murals of the great players, the players whose numbers are retired and some of the other greats. So even though it's not the Montreal Forum, which had so much history, this building has been open now for 25 years. There's a lot of history in the Bell Center, the 23 Stanley Cups, 33 Stanley Cup appearances. It's hard to believe that it's been so long, 28 years since the Canadians were in a Stanley Cup final, but it will be so exciting to be up there and be a part of those games. And you mentioned the press box. It's a great location. It's one of the best in the league from a broadcast standpoint. It's similar to New York now with the new bridge at Madison Square Garden. You feel like you're looking right down on the ice. You're high up, but it's not far back. It's an overhang. So for those who haven't been up there, for the viewers and listeners, from our perspective covering the games, it's one of the best locations that you could ask for in the entire league.
I love that building. I think it's, I always tell people that if you're going to go, you know, you want to go see a hockey game and you have an opportunity to get to the Bell Center for a Montreal Canadiens game, even in the regular season, you got to do it. It's an experience. There's no question about it. It's especially when it's full. Kenny, for you, what is this opportunity for you like? I mean, you called a lot of big games over the course of your career, but here you are calling the Stanley Cup final now too. So what does this mean to you?
Well, it's been so exciting, almost surreal, knowing that I would call the entire series on the TV side. I've called 8 Stanley Cup final series on the radio,
right?
7 of them on national radio, for Westwood One and one with the Rangers. Did call one game on TV back in 2014. It was game one in LA when Doc Emmerich had to attend a funeral. So I had a taste of it with that one game 7 years ago, but a great crew to be a part of. Couldn't ask for better partners in Eddie Olczyk and Brian Boucher and Pierre Maguire and Catherine Tappan and the production crew. Just top notch and so exciting to be here last night in the building and look forward to game two tomorrow.
How does it change for you? Doing radio and TV, is there a big change? Do you even think about it?
There is a change. The preparation is the same. That doesn't change. But as far as during the game, on radio, you have to be so descriptive. And the play-by-play announcer is pretty much talking during the entire time while the puck's in play. Now, you might take a pause and let your analyst come in if the puck's not in one of the offensive zones. But there's definitely a much different pace and energy level to radio. On television, you don't call as many names. The folks watching can see what's going on. You don't have to be as descriptive. You don't have to give the score and time as often. There is more time for your analyst to come in. Now, with our TV broadcast with NBC, there are usually two analysts. Eddie upstairs, for example, last night, and Brian Boucher inside the glass. So that lends itself to even less time for the play-by-play announcer because you're trying to allow the two analysts, you know, their time. And they're the experts. They're the former players that the people want to hear from. Obviously, I'm calling the play and interjecting notes and nuggets and stats throughout the game. But with two analysts, it's even even more challenging and a lot more different than it normally would be with only one analyst. So, yes, major differences between a radio and a television call.
What's Eddie Olczyk like during a broadcast? Because, I mean, the guy catches everything, you know, before the replay shows it. Is he like frantically looking at replays while you're calling the game to catch something? What's he doing during a broadcast?
You know, it's crazy. I've worked with a lot of analysts, a lot of great analysts through the years. And, you know, I'll put guys like John Davidson and Joe Micheletti, you know, right up there with the guys I'm working with now. And Dave Maloney, who I've done the Rangers with for 16 years. You know, they're all in that similar category as far as the job they do. I think Eddie and Brian work so well together, first of all. I've been involved in hockey now for 31 years on the broadcast side. I still learn something every day during each and every game. There's something that Eddie or Brian points out, and I'm just shocked at how they pick it up, some of the things they see. And Eddie is constantly on the talk back with the truck, setting up his next replay, his next telestration. But just a brilliant hockey mind. He's done it all. He was an Olympian, a great player in the NHL, a coach, a broadcaster for a long time. He's just been involved in so many different facets of the game. And like I said, I'm amazed every game that I work with Eddie on some of the little things that he picks up throughout the course of the game. And then in the terrific manner in which he's able to explain it to the viewers who are watching on television and using his telestrator as he does throughout the game and setting up specific replays. You know, I think he's definitely the gold standard these days. You know, he replaced JD as the national analyst on NHL games, and the torch was passed, and JD did an unbelievable job. He really set the tone, set the standard. Back when nobody else had satellite capabilities, JD had one of the early satellite dishes, and he started just raising the bar as far as the research, talking to coaches and players and general managers and going to morning skates. And I think that was passed along to guys like Eddie and Pierre and Joe Micheletti and now Brian Boucher and some of the others. But the standard was definitely raised by John Davidson, and Eddie took the torch back in 2006, and he's carried it right through ever since.
You talk a lot about the crew, and I think one of the reasons that Eddie is so good is because, A, he's approachable. Like, you understand him, even if you're not a huge hockey fan, and he's genuine. But you've talked about the whole group, and we're coming to an end of an era here, and, you know, there's going to be new TV partners next year. I'm curious, as you come towards the finish line, and it's such an important time in the year, is there almost a bittersweetness to it?
Well, I'm biased, obviously, having worked for NBC on the NHL side for the last decade at the Winter Olympics since 2002. And I don't think that NBC gets enough credit for basically everything they've done in covering the sport for the last 15 years. First of all, you had Doc Emmerich, the greatest hockey play-by-play announcer in the United States of all time, in most people's opinion, the Vin Scully of hockey. You had guys like Eddie and Pierre and Brian and Keith Jones in the studio and so many of the others who did such a remarkable job and still do in promoting the sport and explaining the sport to the viewers. With the advent of the inside the glass position, something that Sam Flood, the president of NBC Sports, introduced with Pierre about 15 years ago, that has led to about 50 jobs around the league. When you think about it, because every team on their local broadcasts, most teams have somebody inside the glass, whether it's a former player or a reporter, all of the various networks in the U.S. and Canada. So if not for Sam Flood introducing the inside the glass position with Pierre initially, there are probably 50 hockey people out there who would not have jobs these days if that had not taken place. NBC was heavily involved in the introduction of the Winter Classic and the Stadium Series and some of the other outdoor games, which has raised millions and millions of dollars for the league and the teams. And it's become such a huge event. So I think when the history books are written, there are so many positives that have come out of NBC's relationship with the league. And Eddie and Boucher and I look forward to continuing to carry the torch, you know, for as long as this series extends.
Well, definitely. And that's a good question, right? How long will the series extend? I'm not going to ask you here for a prediction of any sort, Kenny, but what we saw, and I mean, what do you think, what kind of style do you think this series will take on? Do you think it's a lot of what we saw in game one, regardless of the result, or do you think it could open up a little bit, or is it going to be even tighter than we saw? What are you expecting for the rest of this series?
Well, I usually try to stay out of the prediction business.
Yeah, no prediction.
A, I'm usually wrong, and B, I have to call the games, but you have two of the best goaltenders in the league at this point in Carey Price and Andrei Vasilevskiy, so anything can happen. Either of these guys can pitch a shutout in any game. That's number one. Number two, if you told me that after Colorado had a 2-0 lead on Vegas and had a 1-goal lead with 6 minutes left in game three, that they were going to lose the next four games, I would have told you you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And how many people expected Montreal to have a chance against Vegas? So you just never know. You know, obviously Tampa Bay is the defending champs. They've won seven straight series and they looked strong last night. So, you know, I'm sure in their fans' minds, you know, they could feel it. It's only three wins away now. But if Price comes up with a huge game tomorrow, if the Canadians do what they were able to do in winning 11 of the last 13 games, and if they tie the series and then heading home with all the excitement playing in Bell Center, who knows? So I know I'm not really answering the question, but you know, I'm certainly hoping it's a long series. I'd love to call a game seven. Who wouldn't in a Stanley Cup final? So we'll have to wait and see what develops over the next 2 weeks.
I have to ask you, you talked about all of your experience and everything else that's gone on in hockey for you. Right now, have you seen anybody play better than Nikita Kucherov is playing?
Wow, he's been outstanding. And when you look at some of the numbers, we put up a graphic during game seven of the Islander series. Assists over two consecutive playoffs. He's right up there with Wayne Gretzky, and that's it. They're the only two guys on the list. So from Kucherov to Braden Point, right on down, Victor Hedman, Ryan McDonough, the way he's playing, Vasilevskiy, there's a reason why these guys have had so much success. Third Stanley Cup final in the last 7 years, second straight year. But Kucherov, you know, it's amazing. Didn't play a regular season game. He steps right in and he's having an incredible playoff run once again.
Yeah, no, he's been incredible. And Kenny, it is always incredible to watch and listen to your broadcasts. And I'm sure everybody continues to look forward to them. And I hope you're right, Kenny. I hope it goes to game seven. I hope you get to call a game seven, because I think that would be a pretty magical way to end a very strange, unique, yet pretty awesome season too, right?
Well, that would be a lot of fun. We'll see what happens. Great to chat with you guys as always, and we'll probably see you up in the press box tomorrow.
Great to catch up with Kenny there, Sean. He calls such a good game, and he will continue to call them in this series for NBC, but he'll also continue to call them starting next season for Turner as well. He'll be on TNT, so he's the lead broadcaster going there as well, and Eddie Olczyk is joining him there, and I know ESPN just announced their talent roster as well, right, Sean?
Yeah, no, it's such an exciting time for those that are into the broadcast business as we kind of change over to new partners and, you know, people are moving or new people are being put into the mix. When you look at ESPN and, you know, what they're going to do, it's a lot of familiar names, right? Like Ray Ferraro is still going to be involved. Brian Boucher, who you know, Kenny talked about a lot. Sean McDonough is going to be the lead play-by-play guy. Our good friend Kevin Weeks from NHL Network will be involved, and Ryan Callahan as well. But then they're adding new voices, right? AJ Molesko is going to get more of a national run, and I think she's been fantastic. She was great on the Islander series. Rick DiPietro, the former Islander goalie who does radio here in New York, is going to get a little bit of a run. Mark Messier, like ESPN's really trying to do stuff, and Chris Chelios is involved, who's never really done this, but I'm excited to see what he does because he's such a sharp hockey mind. And then, you know, I mentioned AJ Molesko, but Hillary Knight's going to be involved, Blake Bolden. So there's a whole spectrum of players from all different levels and leagues and everything else. It's probably the widest variety of voices that the NHL's ever had on a platform.
And Wayne Gretzky will be on Turner too. So, I mean, you get that type of analysis as well. So, no, that'd be good. And ESPN's going to get, Gary Bettman announced this in his press conference, yesterday before game one, ESPN is going to get the first round of the NHL draft, and also the Seattle expansion draft will be on ESPN. So that is exciting stuff for down the road, for a little less than a month from now. But we've still got business to tend to here in the Stanley Cup final. And before we get to our interview with Jan Ruda, Sean, Dominique Ducharme remains out, but he could be back coaching the Montreal Canadiens game three when this series shifts to Montreal. You know, it's almost, I mean, I don't know if this storyline has gotten kind of brushed under the rug a little bit here, but Luke Richard, I mean, the Canadiens don't have their head coach and they're in the Stanley Cup final. It's unique. I mean, in a unique season with COVID and everything, it's because of COVID, yet here they are. I got to wonder just how Dominique Ducharme is really handling all this, just not be here in the Stanley Cup final with his team.
Well, it's got to be crushing, right? You've worked your whole life in hockey. You take over this team from Claude Julien midseason. You get them back on the right track. You put them on this amazing run where they beat their fiercest rival in a 3-1 comeback, and you know, and then sweep Winnipeg, and you're on top of the world, and then everything gets pulled out from under you. I think, you know, two things. It hasn't gotten a lot of notice because the Canadians have continued to win. You know, and Luke Richardson's done a really good job of keeping the team focused. There was no woe is me, you know, and this is a team, let's be honest, that's had a lot of experience with COVID issues during the regular season. Even now, you know, Yoel Armia didn't play in game one because of COVID protocol. He's in Tampa and he's a possibility to play in game two. I guess the good thing is, for the same reason that it's been a good thing for us, is we've been able to do this podcast over Zoom throughout the past 15 months. Dominique Ducharme gets to be a part of his team because of technology, right? He can, yep. He can be broadcast into the room. He can talk to Richardson whenever he wants. You know, you think about 10 years ago, if this happened, he would literally be isolated. There would be no way to communicate. You know, you almost think of when the baseball manager gets thrown out of the game, right? And he's in the locker room and he's on the phone or he's passing notes. He's having the bat boy run notes down to the manager. Like, you know, that would almost be the situation that you're in. But because of technology now, I think he's an integral part of what's happening here.
Yeah, no, he's definitely involved. There's no question about it. And he's on Zoom. He talks to the coaches, I think, you know, but obviously before the game, goes over game plans, I mean, off days, all these things, probably, you know, a handful of times on those days. And after each period, he's talking with the coaching staff to go over plans and all that, but he's just got to be watching from home. But game three in Montreal, ideally, that's the game that he is back behind the bench for the Montreal Canadiens. But that's not Jan Ruda's problem, right? That's not Jan Ruda doesn't care about that. Jan Ruda only cares about what's going on with the Tampa Bay Lightning. And we were fortunate enough to catch up with the Lightning defenseman to talk about this series, the team in general, all the above. Here's that interview with Jan Ruda. Jan, thanks so much for hopping on with us. So here we are again in the Stanley Cup final. And just, what is this like? I mean, explain that. I mean, yeah, you got a 1-0 lead. It's great. And you played a strong game one. You're going into game two. What's this experience like for you now that you got fans too roaring in the building?
Yeah, I mean, the fans are great. I mean, last year, we obviously didn't have the fans. So everybody in the locker rooms enjoying the fans, you know, a lot of guys on the team, they're fortunate enough to have family in the stands as well, you know, so really happy for them. It's definitely special.
Now, how important is the depth that you guys have on defense? When you look at game one and you kind of look at Montreal throughout the playoffs, they've relied on a top three or a top four, play a ton of minutes. And then you look at you guys in game one and it was right. Everybody was within maybe 4 minutes of each other. As you go along in this playoff run, how much is the ability to kind of roll six defensemen helped?
It's great. And I mean, obviously, we know who the big guys in our team are. So it's good that we can help them to have a little breather, you know, so they don't have to eat up as much minutes and can have some rest.
You play with maybe the biggest in Victor Hedman. You know, size-wise, perhaps, although maybe Eric Chernak could, you know, stand next to him and beat him. I don't know. But certainly in terms of stature in the league and what he's done, what's that like to play with Victor Hedman? What's your role playing with him and just the experience of playing with him? Just describe that to me.
You know, he's obviously he's such a great player, and he kind of elevates me every day because I know how great of a player he is, and I'm just trying to keep up with him, all the thing he's doing. You mentioned his physique and how he's moving and how much energy he has every game, every shift. You know, it's something I admire, and just trying to not to let him down, and trying to catch up.
As a defenseman, as you go through these playoffs, do you find yourself sometimes sitting on the bench and saying to somebody, "Thank God I don't have to defend Kucherov in point"?
every game, and I think every power play.
What makes them so good? Give me a scouting report as a defenseman.
Scouting report? I mean, Koji just thinks the game on another level. You know, like the things he sees before they actually happen, it's unreal. And the poise he has with the puck, and points, he's just so fast, so shifty. Like, I don't know how he's doing it, but he's even in the practice, he's really here, really tough to contain as a D-man. So, yeah, I'm really, really happy I'm on his team.
Sean brought it up, the idea of the depth that you guys have on D. One of the big storylines going into this series was Montreal's top 4D and how the big four is what they were being called, and how strong they were and how effective they've been in Montreal's run here. I'm talking about obviously Shea Weber, Ben Chiarot, Jeff Petrie. Last one can't come Edmondson. To me right now. What's that?
Joel John? Edmondson.
Yeah, Edmondson. Joel Edmondson, obviously. How could I forget him? So I got to ask, though, when you see a big four getting credit as the way they were, and deservedly, do you guys, as your group of defensemen, kind of take it as a personal challenge to say, we can be better than them?
You know, to be honest, I'm not reading too much media in the playoffs, so I don't really know. I know they play a ton, but I think our forwards are really good with their forecheck, and if they're playing 4Ds, I think we can benefit from that if we get on the forecheck and get some advantage. You know, if you're playing on 4D and you're constantly getting forecheck and hit, it's gonna take a toll. So yeah, I mean, they're great players, but there is something that we can benefit from, I think.
Jan only reads NHL.com, so he gets all his information
and listens
there.
To this podcast, of course.
But Jan, I'm curious. We saw in game one, and again, we've seen through the playoffs with the Canadians, they like to get around the net, especially Gallagher, and try and disrupt the goalies and play physical on their forecheck. There were a ton of hits. There were over 100 hits in game one. I'm curious, as a player in general, do you feed off when you know that it's going to be physical, especially in that area around the crease, and it's going to be difficult to keep people away from your goaltender?
Yeah, I mean, I think our defensive group, as last 2 years, we've been embracing that role of playing physical, and we will commit. I think a lot of guys get better being physical down low, and I think we always respond well with against the teams that want to play that style. So yeah, I mean, it's good. It helps you to get into the game, get some passion going, So I like it.
Playing with Andre Vasilevsky, knowing that he's behind you, what does that do for you in terms of what you want to do on the ice as well? Describe his personality a little bit, especially on the ice. What we don't see a lot of that. We don't hear a lot of that. What's he like on the ice?
Boy, he's the best goalie on the ice. So, I mean, he's great. He tries to help us with the breakouts too. You know, his stick work got a lot better as he's been in the league, so it's great. He talks to us too, so he's doing some work for us, obviously making saves, but helping us with breakouts. That's huge for us as well.
You spoke in the earlier part of this about the fans being in the building and some players having family there and stuff. I'm curious for you, what's the biggest positive or the thing that you enjoy the most about having fans back in the building and in such large numbers?
When you clinch a series or score a goal or score a big goal, you, like, the emotions are high, and that's the time when you kind of want to look in the stands and just see that that emotion and like kind of the same reaction. And we've seen this in our building a lot of times this playoffs. I mean, just score a goal or clinch a series, like when the fans are happy and the place is loud, it's great, you know.
Do you hear them in the locker room when you guys, before the game, I mean, when you're about to come out on the ice, is that something you hear? Do you hear the crowd from there?
Yeah, you hear the crowd, you hear the music, you know. Yeah, it's something we missed last playoffs, and it's something we definitely enjoy this year.
Everybody talks about in the playoffs, and you have to worry about the Canadians because they've done it in every round. How difficult is it for you guys to keep an even keel when you're playing like you did last night?
I mean, we know the recipe. I mean, it's worked for us last year and this year. And I think we, like, this group really responds well to adversity and challenges. So, I mean, yeah, we know that we won the game, but it's just the one game. So, you know, we got to win four, but we just want to win one and four times.
Last one for you, Jan, and thanks so much for doing this with us. You mentioned we know the recipe, right? So I was asking the question last night to John Cooper, you know, why is this team so good at sticking with the game plan? The game plan is in place, but sometimes the game plan can blow up in your face at times in a game because the game can go awry or things happen. Yet more times than not, you guys have stuck with the game plan in these playoffs and it's worked in your favor. So why? Why is this team so good at just sticking with that?
I mean, yeah, like last year we saw what works, and like the year before when we were the best team in the league after the regular season, we got swept by Columbus. So we saw what's not working when we're kind of all over the place. We're just chasing offense, trying to cheat on some plays, and it usually backfires. So I think everybody knows both ways, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And we obviously remember the success we had last year, so everybody wants to stay on that course.
Great, Jan. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Good luck in game two and the rest of the series.
Okay, thanks guys for having me.
Definitely thanks to Jan Rutta and the Lightning for that interview. Good to get a player to come on the podcast in the middle of the Stanley Cup final after game one to get that perspective. So I hope all the listeners enjoyed it. Sean, there's also a lot of news and notes that have gone on around the NHL. And we'll get to all that before we sign off here. Gary Bettman at his press conference, like I mentioned earlier, before game one, made some big announcements. Las Vegas is going to get the All-Star game next year. Dates to be determined. There's going to be the Winter Classic game will be at Target Field in Minneapolis, Wild and Blues, as it was expected to be supposed to be last, you know, this year, but didn't happen, obviously. That's January 1st, 2022. And the Tampa Bay Lightning are going to get an outdoor game, but it's in Nashville. I'm calling it right now, by the way. I'm going to that game. So just want to lay it out there, put it in public, put it on the record. That's my, I'm going to that game. I hope that I can go work that game, but I'm going to it anyway, at Nissan Stadium in Nashville, Predators, Lightning, February 26th. So exciting times for next season, which, as Gary Bettman said, looks like it's going to be normal.
Huge announcements as we get back more towards normal. You know, the All-Star game dates to be determined in part because of the Olympics. And, when you know, the NHL doesn't know what it's doing for the Olympics. The deadline is nigh, as Erik Karlsson might say. You know, they need to know. They need to know what the IOC is doing, what the parameters are going to be. You know, Gary said the schedule would come out sometime between the end of the season and the draft. And, you know, they need to know if there's
they need to know
to make the schedule. I mean, they have two schedules, and you know, whichever one ends up taking effect will be the one that comes out. But, you know, that's the huge domino that's still left out there. That'll determine European games, the return of those to the calendar and everything else. So we're still in a wait and see mode on the Olympics, but the end is near.
Yeah, no, and I know everybody wants to go. The players don't certainly want to go. The Lightning talked about it today. Victor Hedman was asked about it. John Cooper, who's a candidate certainly to coach Team Canada, was asked about it. Everybody wants to go, but there's so many things that go on that are associated with going to the Olympics that the NHL and the NHLPA have to determine in the end. You know, is it worth it? But as Gary Bettman and Bill Daly alluded to in the press conference, they negotiated in good faith with the NHLPA and the collective bargaining agreement. that if all details could be worked out, they'd go to the Olympics, and that they stand true to that. So, but time is running short, as they said. One other bit of news that's kind of happened as we have been recording this podcast, the Buffalo Sabres have officially named Don Granato their full-time head coach. He was their interim head coach, took over for Ralph Krueger last season, and he is now their official full-time head coach. He was the Sabres were 9-16-3 under Granato. Now that might look bad, and you might say to yourself, well, why would they bring that guy on? It was an improvement. They were an improved team under Don Granato, and he gets an opportunity that I know he's been waiting for, to be a full-time head coach in the NHL, and away they go. But so we got, what do we got? One more opening left now with Arizona, right? With Dave Hackstall being named the coach of the Seattle Kraken, and now Granato here. One more opening in the coaching business left for a head coaching job in the National Hockey League.
And if things continue to go the way they're going, it's going to be a complete wild card.
Yeah.
I have no idea who it was. I don't know if Don Granato was the favorite in Buffalo. You know, they had interviewed a lot of big names. Clearly, Dave Hackstall comes out of left field in Seattle. Nobody expected that. And even Brad Larson in Columbus, you know, a bit against the grain. So who knows who's going to fill that job in Arizona, and that'll close the books. But it wasn't just one piece of news, Dan. It was a few pieces of news, and the NHL doesn't do what the NFL does, where they try and clamp down on news during the Stanley Cup, during the Super Bowl, and just have everything focused on the Super Bowl. Our business continues to go on. The other big piece of news today is that the Edmonton Oilers signed Ryan Nugent-Hopkins to an 8-year, $41 million deal. I like the deal. I know you don't.
I just don't know about 8 years. I don't like giving 8 years to most players unless you're talking about like Kucherov or McDavid or Hedman, you know, elite talent that you absolutely have to keep around. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is a good player, but now you got him for 8 years. And I think there's a no movement clause in that deal as well. Somewhere in that deal. So it's not that I don't like the player. I just don't like the term. The money's great. For $5 million about a year, that's good. Especially if you think the cap within those 8 years is going to rise, but that's a long time to have the same guy in a team that they've had him for a while and they haven't won anything. They haven't been successful. So it's sticking with the same for a long time when you haven't done anything with, and it's not just the one player, but it's the team.
Yeah. Well, you're not getting them for $5 million a year unless you're giving them that term. So I think it was a trade of term for money, and you're right. The cap will go up. And I think at the end of this deal, it's a much more affordable deal for the Oilers, and he'll be 36 when he's done, right? And he'll be a career Oiler. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think franchises need players like that, and not the McDavids and not the Draisaitls, who are the superstars and carry it. Like, you know, you look at Tampa Bay now and like a Tyler Johnson, right? Like they're the guys that kind of carry the fabric of the organization and move it forward. And, you know, I think Nugent Hopkins can be that guy as he ages.
On June 29th, 2029, we will have a conversation about Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and how this deal went on this podcast. Does that work for you?
I just marked it on my calendar.
There you go. the other thing, by the way, before we get out of here, and I know we've taken up a lot of your time, but Marc-Andre Fleury said he wants to stay in Vegas and continue playing with Robin Lehner, which I don't know if that's going to happen. I really don't. I don't know if it should happen. When you look at the holes that the Vegas Golden Knights had, especially down the middle, but Fleury and Lehner formed a nice little bond there and they want to stay together. You don't want to mess with good goaltending, but it's also about $12 million of goaltending.
Yeah, no, that's a tough number and a flat cap to keep. And you know, I also think it causes problems. I thought it caused problems late in the playoffs when they had to decide who was going to play. I think that's a hard decision for a coach. I think he wants to know who his guy is. And, you know, you make that decision and you live and die with it, right? Like you go with Varlamov because he's the best goalie. And nobody can be like, oh, you should have put in Sorokin. I think coaches like that. And like you said, the money is a huge consideration. But Marc-Andre is going to need more and more help as he gets a little bit older, right? The split's going to have to be better. But the last thing on Vegas before we go, to me, the most amazing thing is Alec Martinez played the whole playoffs with a broken foot.
He's a hockey player.
I can't even cover a game with a hangnail. I need to shut her down for a day and recover. And this guy played the whole series, and he led the league in blocks. He led the whole league in blocks through three rounds while he was trying to protect a broken foot. It's just amazing.
Well, I mean, typing with a hangnail is hard, man. I understand.
Especially the way I type.
Yeah, exactly. You do. You bang away at a computer. You need new keyboards. Anyway, this was fun. Definitely thank Kenny Albert for hopping on with us, and Jan Rutta as well. Only one game in the books in the Stanley Cup Final. And Sean, I'm going to leave you with this. Skate, protect the house. You got to protect the house. All right? I hope she's back.
It's been great. We'll talk to you next week.